a lot of support.
Any other words you'd like to share?
Thanks for coming.
Actor Sean Penn speaking to us in Haiti. The two-time Oscar award-winning actor now is a camp manager at a tent camp. He manages in Pétionville in Port-au-Prince. The tent camp has 55,000 Haitians made homeless by the earthquake. His organization is JPHRO, JPHaitianReliefOrganization.org. Special thanks to Nicole Salazar, Sharif Abdelkadous, and Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
And you're listening to radio station WUSB Stony Brook. Time is 1 minute after 6 o'clock. Time, once again, for Off the Wall. Very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening. Joined tonight once again by Kyle.
Hi there.
How you doing?
I'm very well. And yourself?
I'm okay. I'm okay. You know what? I am okay.
Yeah, you look well.
But your mic died. I wasn't anywhere near it, and it's just stopped working. Keep talking.
I'm talking.
All right. Good. All right.
I was just saying you look well.
And see, it went out again. You can't hear. You don't have headphones. We lack the capability to have headphones. I'm going to jiggle the switch. Keep talking.
I'm speaking about how well you are.
Yeah, I'm well.
What's wrong with my mic?
I don't know. Welcome to USB. This is where things like this happen. Okay, it's all right now. I'm, don't touch the microphone. Oh,
okay.
My God.
I thought I had
what are you trying
it.
To do?
All right.
Oh. Okay.
So it's working now.
Well, it's working on this end. All right, the switch has a problem on the board. It's dirty or something. But the microphone, I don't know. That's your department, your territory. So,
all right.
Yeah, no, it's we're good here. We're fine. This is actually normal for us. It's the week before. It's the week of hope. It's the week of the Hackers on Planet Earth conference. So we've been going a bit mad. In fact, a lot of people have been going a bit mad preparing things. The Hope conferences are basically the culmination of the efforts of hundreds of people around the world to make things happen. And it's kind of magical. You know, it starts on Friday. Today is now Tuesday, and every day gets a little bit more intense. So we have to make sure things arrive, things aren't forgotten.
Yeah, there's a lot of logistics going on, right?
So many logistics. Yeah, it's insane. To give you one example, we had a shipment of the Club Mate German beverage coming over. Five pallets, that's 4,000 bottles. And we're the only people that have figured out how to get that stuff into this country, because believe me, it's a lot of paperwork, it's a lot of hassle, a lot of fees and things like that, but it is so worth it when you see all the happy people that are similar to happy people in Germany, except they're here in America, and they have this hacker beverage. And I call it a hacker beverage because hackers really go for this kind of thing. It keeps you awake, but doesn't give you the sugar crash. You can probably explain it better than I can.
It's got a light, mild tea flavor, and it's a natural form of caffeine,
mm-hmm.
Actually called matine, but it's a form of caffeine, and you don't crash because some of these other drinks have like synthetic forms of caffeine and a lot of sugar and other chemicals in there, but this is just sort of a caffeinated beverage that's lightly sweetened and also lightly carbonated. It's not, you know, really, really the same kind of carbonation you get from like a traditional soft drink. So.
Right. So the sugar crash, how do you describe that to somebody who might not have experienced it? What's it like? Just kind of...
Well, yeah, like, you get, your heart's racing, that kind of thing, and then afterwards you're sort of, you know, maybe headaches, or just you come down from this intense amount of high dosages of sugar and that kind of thing, and you end up, you know, being kind of tired, you know, like, fatigued.
Fatigued, yeah, from, worn out.
Yeah, because your system's been sort of overloaded with these very high dosages of what are generally like synthesized foods, and then you seek another one, and it just sort of continues from there. I think with this drink, it feels a lot better. It's more natural, and it's not as intense. It's a different kind of energy. You know, it gives you a little pep, but
so
it's
when
not
you stop,
overwhelming.
When you stop drinking it, you just sort of fade back down to where the level you should be at.
Yeah, it's so subtle you can't really, I mean, I can't really describe it. It's you just sort of you aren't overwhelmed from the drink to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, you're subtly kind of, you're awake, you're alert, that kind of thing, but it's not overwhelming. You don't feel like your heart's, you know, racing or anything like that, like some of these, you know, major drinks you get in the fuel station or whatever side of the highway. You know, these drinks are a little much more subtle, and it's really refreshing, actually.
So that's why we like to introduce this kind of thing to the hacker community, because it's something that's a tradition over in Germany, and
I
travel, I like to find new traditions and share them with people.
It's really catching on, too.
It really is.
People get more and more excited. The more we talk about it, the more we introduce people,
they
turn them on to it. It's
jump
like,
up and down. You think they've been drinking it already.
Yeah, and you find they, you know, want to know about it. Or, hey, where is it? Are we getting some for the conference? That whole thing.
Well, to answer that question, we were asking that question quite a lot, actually, because it was the only way to get it is to get it on a cargo container, much like the one that I took across the Pacific Ocean a number of years ago.
You rode in a cargo container?
I didn't ride in the cargo. I was in one of the little suites that they give you. Only two passengers
just,
on the
I'm
whole
just
thing.
Kidding.
I didn't think you really thought I rode in a cargo container. But I wouldn't mind doing that, though. And I in fact, I stood in a cargo container at tour camp last year, about a year ago, in Washington State. I stood in fact, I think I recorded part of this show inside a cargo container.
Oh, that's right. We did. We had all the cargo containers. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Intermodal. You were involved. I didn't know you at the time, but you were involved in the group that brought the cargo container over.
That's right. I helped out with them. I think it's called an intermodal shipment container.
Oh, it was really cool. Yeah. Whatever. Well, I'd never actually been inside one before.
Anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, you're saying. It's all fascinating.
The shipment came across.
Yeah, an incredibly complex story of only one facet of the entire conference. But yeah, we ordered 5 pallets. A pallet holds, I think, 800 bottles?
Yes, 800 bottles. This is a Euro pallet.
Right, so we're talking 4,000 bottles. 5 times 800 is correct, 4,000. We had 4,000 bottles in 5 pallets coming over the Atlantic Ocean in a freighter, a cargo container. It arrived. It arrived on the 5th of July, I believe. And it takes a couple of days to offload these things. If you've ever seen a cargo container, they have so many of the things. You need these robotic cranes to get them all. And, of course, the one that you want is buried inside somewhere. And then that has to be unloaded. 5 pallets really doesn't take up that much space, even though it's a lot. But as is our custom, it seems, no pun intended, customs tends to look at our shipments rather closely. And it was delayed, and there was some concern that it would be delayed longer and that we might not get it till sometime next week, which doesn't do us a whole lot of good.
And we're familiar with this. This has happened before, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this time we're sort of tapping our fingers saying, well, really, how long is it going to take this time?
It's funny. It's uproariously funny because what they can do, if they think you're suspicious for whatever reason, they can delay your shipment for weeks. And not only that, you have to pay extra for them to delay your shipment by weeks. You have to, like, pay them rent or something. And it's so this is why people don't do this, because it's so frustrating. And we ordered this in plenty of time. We assumed it would get here in time, but up until today, we weren't sure it was going to make it actually to the conference. Today, we found out that in fact it has been released, will be delivered, and there'll be plenty of Club Mate at Hope.
Oh, that is such good news.
I should end the show on that, because that's such a high note to end on.
All right, we're done.
All right. 45 minutes of dead air, and then we'll be on after that.
No, that's thrilling news. Because I know there's going to be a lot of people that want, you know, something to drink, and there's so many people that know it's coming to the conference and are really anticipating this. So, it's going to be really good. Everybody's going to have some.
Yeah, and we'll have special prices, too. If you want to buy an entire pallet, we'll have a special price for that, but also for cases and things. But that's only one very small part of the entire conference. We have over 100 speakers. Or actually over 100 talks, I think nearly 200 speakers. We have Segway rides, we've got the Hackerspace Village, the Lockpick Village. The list goes on and on. Just go to hope.net. You know, we have iPhone apps for the badges and Android apps for the badges. I don't even know what that means exactly, but these badges are the coolest thing ever. You've seen them. You've touched them. You've held them.
Absolutely, yeah. I actually counted all of them.
I have, too, but you understand it a lot better than I do.
Yeah, the badges are part of the Attendee Metadata Project, which is a project of the conference, and it's basically the first several thousand pre-registrations get one of these badges, and we have access points that are a part of the Open Beacon project, and we're going to install them on the top floor and then on the first and second floors, or maybe just the second floor of the mezzanine. And so everywhere that the conference is going to be held, there will be the ability to track every badge. And from what I've heard, these badges have a lot more capabilities and even some things you can do as far as modifying them. And what we do is we get a tremendous amount of data on where everybody is and what they're doing. And these apps and the way smartphones have evolved, it sounds like there's going to be a lot more interaction. Because I remember the last conference where we first had this type of badge. We didn't find out about there was a button on the badge where you could vote during the conference. I didn't even find out about that until like the third day when they talked about what the functionality of the badges are. So I feel like there's going to be all these capabilities that we're going to know about a lot sooner so that we can actually interact and try some of the capabilities.
Right. And we have two panel discussions just about the badges. One of them is how to manipulate and even break the badges, not break them permanently, but just how to break the system and hack into it and things like that, and another on just how it was all done. So, there's a lot of interest in this. A lot of work has gone into the development. People have been working on this for a year. And again, that's just one part of the conference.
There's going to be special performances, too, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be vendor tables.
Vendors,
places where people, you know, involved. Maybe they were they came to their first hacker conference a while ago, and now they've got a project or a business or some form of information they want to disseminate amongst the community. That's going to be really interesting. And then you already mentioned the Hackerspace Village, but all kinds of art installations. I believe we've got a whole team of artists that are working hard to really tie together all the ideas and themes that we've been working on for this conference.
It's incredible to see the different communities tying together art and social activism and technical hacking and phones. It never ends, and it's getting bigger and bigger. We have more pre-registrants this time than we have ever had before. We have more speakers than we've ever had before, and just a lot of anticipation for this. And we've done it so many times before that it's almost routine. It's almost something we can just do without a whole lot of fuss. But, of course, there are always those things you don't plan for.
And, of course, it's in the middle of New York City, so there's going to be the ability to sort of break away, go out and meet people, you know, have a meal, share some ideas, you know, catch up with old friends, meet some new ones. And just it's that theme, that feeling of you know, open discussion and sharing in your community and hearing what people have to say, and then, you know, maybe coming up with some of your own ideas or you know, bouncing your ideas off of other people that maybe have experience in either technical things, social things, you name it, scientific things, art, all of that. We get to share, we get to come together, we have people that understand all kinds of different things. Whether it's, you know, extremely technical or not that technical, more, you know, philosophic or artistic, whatever it may be, we can all sort of get together and be a big team and kind of present ourselves right there in the middle of New York, the Hotel Pennsylvania, and really celebrate and see where everybody's at this summer. So,
now, Kyle, you're doing a talk on Telephone Pioneers of America. We've mentioned this on Off the Hook and Off the Wall last week, but we've had some very interesting revelations as you've been preparing this talk. Now, first of all, Telephone Pioneers of America has been around for many, many years, and there are many different organizations, and you got involved with the Pioneers out where you live in Seattle, and they meet once a week in an old central office.
Yes.
It still works. The central office still works.
Yeah, the first floor is a working central office. It has a co-location and peering facility.
And the oldest guy there is how old?
The oldest Pioneer at this chapter is 92.
92.
And Andy.
And once a week you go down there. What kinds of things do people do there?
So I live in the neighborhood, and they have the second and third floor established as a telephone museum. It's a 501c3 nonprofit, and it is a project of the Telephone Pioneers, but it is separate. It is called the Museum of Communications. And since I live in the neighborhood, I walk there. You know, they get there around 7 or 8, but I walk there around 8:30, 9. And
7 or 8 in the morning they get there.
They're there early. They get up very early. Some of these guys live up, you know, up in the hills, out in some of the more remote areas in Washington, and they'll drive in at 6 in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Now, not all of them are retired.
Not all of them. To be a pioneer, you have to have worked in the telecommunications industry for 21 years. It was 25. They changed it at one point to 21 years. And so many of them are still active. Sometimes, you know, some younger guys that are working in the industry, maybe they work for Quest or they work for a telecommunications company, they'll come by on their break. They'll come by maybe from another part of their area because they don't have the capability of seeing working historical equipment in an actual central office, in C2, as it were. I mean, these are working switches. And what I mean by that is these are works of art. I mean, very beautiful mechanical switching systems installed in a central office. So they're installed where you might have found them hundred years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful. They've got every single generation of telephone switch, and they all work. And they have a plethora of other equipment there as well. So it's a place where sort of industry guys that are not yet maybe thinking about becoming a pioneer, maybe they're on their 15th year of service and they're considering it, or they've gotten some letters from the group saying, you know, hey, you know, come on in, you know, maybe we want to introduce you to some of the guys, see if you might like this organization. But essentially, it's a place where some of the retired guys can go and be a resource for guys that are in the industry and the community in general. The Telephone Pioneers have a huge fellowship initiative, and so they do a lot of like community outreach. And you know, for people like me, I can go there and get things repaired. I can get, you know, a telephone line, you know, or now, parts. And
that's where you went for to fix the phone that you bought in Dayton. And we've been covering this story since it first broke.
Yeah.
Where you found the phone at the table next to the 2600 table outside in the parking lot there. And this guy had a desk phone, a standard black rotary desk phone.
Model 500 actually is a 501.
501. And that's the kind of phone that many of us have seen at some point in our lives, those of us over 30 at least. And
it's from 1957.
1957. And you took that to the museum to repair it.
Correct.
And did they all gather around while you were doing this?
Some of the guys, they, you know, like Trouble Man Bob, I usually follow
Trouble
him.
Trouble Man Bob. Now, you have to tell me that story.
There's a guy named Bob, and I don't know if he was exactly a Trouble Man when he first started.
What is a Trouble Man?
A Trouble Man fixes things in the central office, things that involve the switch, things that involve people's lines coming into the central office.
Does he have to ride a motorcycle to be called Trouble Man?
No.
Really? Okay, see, I didn't know that.
Although some of those guys really like motorcycles.
Yeah, I would imagine anybody known as Trouble Man would, by default, have a motorcycle. All right, so they're all gathered around, and Trouble Man Bob.
Yeah, he worked on large frames of switches and equipment that is on the telephone company side. So his expertise is not with the client, which would be telephone sets and that kind of thing. But actually the curator, Don, knows quite a bit about repairing telephone sets. And Bob, even though he's not a specifically telephone set oriented, he understands electricity and how you can trace things and how you can test things very, very well. He does this all the time with switches. And normally when I go to visit the museum, I share over, you know, the break room, and then sort of people break away and we have different projects. And if we don't have any specific project, I'll hang out with Bob and sort of follow him around and try to learn some of the equipment that he spent his career working on, which is the number one crossbar and the number five crossbar are the things that we work on normally. But in this instance, I had a phone, so of course, you know, four or five guys are gathering around and, oh, what are you doing? And I actually opened it up while we were at the break room table. And, you know, the break room's a great place, you know, at around 9:30 or 10, generally a little after I show up, we'll sit down and everybody shares, there's maybe some news articles, we drink some coffee, there's donuts and stuff. And, well, I actually broke out this phone since I had something to fix and started cleaning it up while we're talking over some coffee. And, you know, then people kind of broke away and did their projects, and Bob, you know, said, hey, you know, he basically, you know, was aware I wanted to get it fixed and helped me out just as I had cleaned it up. I was trying to get it to ring because I had cleaned up all the contacts and gotten a new wire in there. And right before I was ready, I said, Bob, do you have some dial tone for me because I wanted to test it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, he had it all ready, little alligator clips and clipped right into one of the switches. I don't even know which one it was.
Just clipped into the switch.
That's right. There's so many of them there. You betcha. You know, he had some dial tone for me. So at that point, we found out something wasn't right. Some of the wires were not hooked up right because this phone had been set up, the one from Dayton, mm-hmm. had been set up for either a party line or some old system, right? So it took some tinkering, and we got we got dial tone, but then we couldn't speak or we couldn't dial out. So, you know, we had half of it, and then we got the other half. And then I think Don came in, and he helped me with actually replacing some of the other parts, or he came in and fixed a certain part to actually be able to speak out or to dial out. So we got halfway through, just Bob and I, and then, you know, somebody else comes. But that's how it goes. It's like Everybody has a different expertise, and you work as sort of a group. And it's the perfect place to bring an old phone like this, because these guys really know the equipment.
A phone that you bought for $3.
That's right.
At Dayton, and now sounds better than any phone that that I talk to anybody on. When you call on a landline, it sounds really amazing. By the way, I should point out, when you mentioned Party Line before, Kyle's not talking about one of these things where you meet similar people on some it's not that kind of a party line.
No.
Party lines used to be very common, especially out in the country, but also in the city. You'd have the same phone number as somebody else, except if the phone rang, I think, two quick rings, that was for the person down the block, three rings, it was for you.
That's right.
And it was something, I never experienced that myself, but it sounds intriguing.
Either a household or a neighborhood would share a line, and you'd have specific rings for each each customer.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And of course, you could listen in on the other people. That was really all you had to do was pick up the phone.
That's right.
But the way that you knew if the phone was for you was the way the phone rang. I guess, you know, like distinctive ringing. That was the first use of distinctive ringing.
You know, Andy told me a story that he was the last person in Seattle to have a party line that actually worked.
Wow.
And they finally made him get rid of it. They said, this service is no longer available. And he had to forfeit his party line. It was a very funny story.
Very sad day, though.
Yeah, exactly.
But on that topic, I've had something very similar happen. Based on this, when I saw that phone, I got intensely jealous, as you know. And I said, I'm going to do you one better, Kyle. I'm going to go get myself a 302 to counter your 501.
I'll see your 501 and raise you a 302.
I saw your 501. And
you saw it, right?
I also saw the 302 on eBay. And what I did was, for $36, which is a fortune compared to your $3, mm-hmm. I was able to get a phone from, I believe, 1947. And these are the kind that are made entirely of metal. And they have a different shape, a slightly different shape than the ones that we're all familiar with.
I'm pretty sure there is some plastic, but there's more metal. I can't verify that.
You could kill somebody with this phone.
It's a much different material mm-hmm. than what your standard 500 from the 60s would be.
And I was lucky because all we had to do was plug the phone in, pretty much. I mean, you had to do a little bit of shenanigans with the wiring.
Yeah, we got a little modular box, and you know. Tied it onto the green and red, and there it goes.
But the wire was like cloth covered, and
yeah,
really
say,
old, really
this,
old.
This 302 that you got is in similar shape as the 501 that I picked up at Dayton. That was in bad shape. The handset cord, which I've since replaced, was in terrible shape, cracked, all kinds of stuff. And I don't know that I actually tested it. I fixed it first thing.
Mm-hmm.
You did something completely different. You received this phone. And we were, you know, admiring it and looking it over. And I had this modular box that I brought for the 501, because I actually brought that because I want to share it for my talk at Hope. So I removed the modular box, and we opened it up, got the two pair. There's actually three wires coming off the end of the phone, the 302. But I took two of them, and that happened to be two that worked. And we plugged a modular right in, and what happened, you know?
It just worked immediately.
You called
it up? Picked it up? Well, first of all, I picked it up and heard the dial tone. It sounded clear as a bell, literally.
Yeah, that's right. You picked it up. And
no hum. Of course, the hum could be on the line, but just the quality through the headset was amazing, and it felt so solid against your head.
And the handset cord is cloth, and it's really, you know, it's in bad shape, but you know what? It worked.
Yeah, and there was no cutting out or static or anything like that.
Amazing.
But then the magic was when I went to a different line. Yes, I have more than one landline. And called this number, which was plugged in now, the ring. I wish I'd recorded it, maybe for next week. No, not for next week, because we'll be recovering from Hope. But soon, record the bell from this phone. It brought back every 1940s and 1950s movie that I'd ever seen. It just sounded so solid and phone-like. That was a phone ringing. That was a phone that needed to be answered. And what did I do? I just let the phone ring for about 30 rings. And it just sounded so incredibly cool.
And isn't it pleasant? You don't get an authentic ring. A lot of the phones you can buy in any sort of electronics store, they're all synthetic. It's
mm-hmm.
all DSP, digital signal processing, you know, like a synthesizer. The ring of a bell is so pleasant, and it makes you want to pick up the phone. It makes you enjoy it.
Well, it made me just want to keep listening to the bell. But there are every single phone has a slight variation of that. I know when I was growing up at my grandmother's house, she had two lines. Well, my grandfather was a doctor, so he had the office line, and they had the residential line, and they had distinctly different sounds. And not only the ring, but the dial. If you were dialing a number, you could hear, oh, they're dialing on 4492, not 7810. Yeah, I'm giving out my docs now. Good luck. and you could just tell this was the line that was used for a particular thing, and it stuck in your mind. That sound would never be forgotten.
Wow.
And I have recordings, so I'm able to listen to that sometimes. And you don't get that pushing little buttons and on cell phones. It's a magic that is lost now, maybe for necessity, but thank God we have ways of preserving it. And getting those old pieces of equipment and talking to the telephone pioneers and strengthening them yourself, as you're doing, those are ways of linking to the history and just making it all matter so much more, inspiring the kids of today, all of that.
And
it's vital.
Indeed. And it's profoundly American history, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to find a phone made in America that is of such quality and so old that still works for such a low price. You were stating, the one I got in Dayton for $3 or even, you know, $20-$30 bucks on eBay is really good for a phone that's more than, you know, 50 years old.
Mm-hmm. So. Absolutely. So your talk is going to be Saturday night, I believe.
Yes, I'll be talking Saturday night.
You're talking in the Bell Room, which is kind of nice.
Yes.
That wasn't intentional. You just wound up in the Bell Room. Every room is named after somebody.
Yeah.
The Tesla Room and the Lovelace Room, and I think we have a Morse Room as well. Yeah, and you'll be speaking, I believe, 8 o'clock on Saturday night. It's in the schedule.
That sounds about right.
Go to www.hope.net. And, of course, Kyle's talk is just one of many talks. And we're doing social engineering after that, and we've got our two keynotes. There's so many things. We easily use up the hour and more going over them all.
It'll be good.
But the discussion we just had is a discussion that we can have about almost any of the talks, and with that much enthusiasm and knowledge to spread around.
Truly, since seeing the schedule, there's not one that I'm not absolutely fascinated by, and I'm really going to either join the discussion and or listen and watch the talks or track them down later. So
absolutely. Now, to sort of tie into this, we've brought back the record that we've been featuring all year long, called Good Friends Are for Keeps, the 100th year celebration album, America Sings of Telephones. This was put out by the Bell System themselves. Yes, they put out the Bell System Presents is what it says here. They put out their own record. And it's basically to celebrate the 100th anniversary, which was back in 1976. So that's quite a while ago that this happened. But we do have another song. There were a total of, I believe, 10 songs on this album, and we've played so far 7 of them. So tonight we'll be playing number 8. But I'd like to read a little bit of history first and just bounce that off of you because you follow this.
No.
Of course, I'm skipping over a good part of it because we've already read much of this. But in 1947, the transistor was invented at Bell Labs,
mm-hmm.
Opening the door to a new world of solid-state electronics. The coast-to-coast dialing of long-distance calls by operators was begun in 1949, 2 years after my phone was built. And, in fact, my phone was built the year that the transistor was invented as well. In 1951, regular coast-to-coast TV transmission began over the newly completed transcontinental radio relay system. A trial of long-distance customer dialing was begun in 1951 from New Jersey to California. New Jersey, of course, is where Bell was headquartered, Bell Labs and all that.
Indeed.
In 1953, the 50 millionth U.S. telephone was installed on the desk of President Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Wow.
What are the odds of that happening?
That's amazing. 50
Him being
what?
The 50 millionth.
50 million.
50 million. Wow.
Wow.
A solar battery was developed by Bell Labs in 1954, a device that was to play an important role in space exploration in the years ahead. The first transatlantic telephone cable was opened for service in 1956. The lowest rate for a call between London and New York at that time was $9. An undersea cable to Alaska was opened a few months later and one to Hawaii in 1957. In 1958, Bell Systems Dataphone Service was announced. Dataphone Service, 1958, a service which permitted high-speed transmission of data over regular telephone circuits. Now, of course, that was probably 50 baht or something. TTY speed, who knows? Something. It's great how you can always call something high speed, but of course that becomes low speed after a couple of years and you have to rename it. A second transatlantic telephone cable system was opened in 1959, this one to the continent of Europe with entry through France. Yeah. Touchtone dialing was introduced in a market trial in Findlay, Ohio in 1960, and the world's first electronic telephone central office, ESS, went to trial operation that same year, 1960. So it goes pretty far back.
Yeah.
Touchtone, electronic switching systems. 1961, the cable laying and repair ship CS Long Lines was launched. CS Long Lines. Also, Wide Area Telecommunications Service. What's another word for that, Kyle? Do you know this? Wide Area Telecommunications Service.
Watts,
yes. A Watts line. Did they use that language over there in the museum? They talk about Watts line?
No.
Whatever? Watts lines are basically...
I'm not familiar with it.
They're, I believe they're toll-free numbers, I think. I mean, I might have that wrong. I might. But
like a different class.
Call on the Watts line. I think that meant call on the toll-free line. You know, again, my memory is a little bit hazy on that. Wide Area Telecommunications, Watts, was first offered. This new service permitted customers to pay a flat monthly rate for interstate long-distance calls instead of paying by the individual call. I don't remember that. I don't remember anything like that existing. But I do remember Watts being used as a word for toll-free calls.
Well, don't be too hard on yourself, because the Bell system came up with a lot of innovation,
mm-hmm.
and there is a lot of history, and it's very easy for you to find something new. And that's the part of the thrill I get out of this timeline and this history.
Let's get to the end of the history here.
Yeah, continue.
We'll get into some music. Telstar, the world's first international communications satellite, rocketed into orbit in July of 1962, and the first telephone call via the satellite was completed from AT&T board chairman Frederick R. Capel to U.S. Vice President Lyndon Johnson. The first commercial ESS central office was put into service at Susquehanna, New Jersey, in 1965, which permitted a whole new series of memory services for customers. I remember, actually, in the early days of 2600 Magazine, where we'd go over to New Jersey, visit some friends over there, and they had things known as call waiting, and I think even caller ID might have been starting to be used. And it just seemed so magical and scary that you could call somebody and they could know who you were before you talked to them. It was really frightening. What did the future hold? In 1966, worldwide direct telephone dialing had its first public demonstration from a Bell System building in Philadelphia to Geneva, Switzerland. That meant actually dialing somebody overseas without operator assistance. And I remember when that wasn't possible. I have no memory. I don't think I was alive for the period where you couldn't dial direct to different parts of this country. But certainly overseas, you needed an operator to help out. And then they introduced 011, which is our prefix for dialing internationally, and country codes and all that. Telephone users began dialing their own calls to London and Paris from Manhattan in a four-month trial in 1967. 80 Manhattan subscribers participated in those tests. In 1970, 24-hour dial and save rates were introduced on interstate calls. I don't know what that means. Dial and save rates. 24-hour dial and save rates. Maybe it's just different rates for different times of the day or something?
Yeah, that's pretty common now. It's amazing that it's 1970 when that started.
Well, do they still have evening rates and night rates and things like that?
Oh, yeah, for mobile phone plans, absolutely. You hear that a lot, don't you?
Well, okay, that's true, free nights and weekends. But I mean,
sure. For
a landline to call someplace, if you call before 5 p.m., it was more expensive.
Sure.
Between 5 and 9, it was, between 5 and 11, I think it was evening, and then 11 on, it was night.
Yeah, I don't think they offer that unless it's like a third-party company or a small telecommunications company. Sometimes those ones do. I don't know if you've seen they're like a, I don't know, what's it, Optimum, some wild
the
company.
Cable system out here.
Yeah, they're using different systems, so they have special deals.
Right. Well, one way they always would get you, New York Telephone was the company here, and the rates I just mentioned were long-distance rates that were for AT&T. Now, this was it was post-divestiture, I guess, because it used to be just, you know, one phone company billed you for everything. But Daytime rates were until 9 p.m. That's what it was for New York Telephone. They were until 5 p.m. for long distance.
Okay.
So you might think you were saving money between 5 and 9, but actually you were still paying daytime rates. And 9 to 11 was their weekend rates. I think I got that right. International direct distance dialing was inaugurated to numerous overseas destinations that same year, 1970. Before the end of 1971, the number of Bell system telephones in service reached 100 million. In 1975, 24-hour, one-minute direct dial rates were introduced with a minimum coast-to-coast rate of 22 cents. And finally, the Bell Systems... Oh, this isn't actually... This is just an exclamation at the end. The Bell Systems' eventful first 100 years, and the second 100 promises more than the first. Yeah. And that's how it ends.
I am absolutely sure it will.
That's the end of the history there. Okay, now some information about the song that we're about to play. This one is called The Girl's Song. Now, songwriters are always searching endlessly for those love song devices, and the telephone seems to offer the songwriter every possibility. Lover's Guilt, for instance. In The Girl's Song, long distance gives our fifth dimension singer a chance to tell her man she's sorry she was unkind. Maybe she's too late, though. She can't reach him. Has he changed his number? Or changed his mind?
So,
yeah.
Is this going out to all the girls out there?
It's going out to all the telephone people out there that appreciate the romance, the history, the importance of the telephone. And we'll be back right after we hear The Girl's Song by The Fifth Dimension.
Goodbye.
Wow, how cool is that? The fifth dimension there with a song from the Telephone Company 100th anniversary album from 1976. We're talking about old phones. We're talking about old music. We're playing music on phonograph records. This is so retro.
Yeah, it is.
It's really kind of cool. And, of course, we're in the antiquated studios of WUSB where we have a fan going to keep us warm. It is keeping us warm, but no, we're fine.
How fitting.
Yeah.
It's all history.
It is. It really is. I'm really looking forward to your talk. I know a lot of people are, and, of course, the conference. More information on the HOPE conference, www.hope.net. A mix of the history, a mix of the new, and just a lot of fun for all.
I know it will be a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to it as well, and I'm going to do my very best.
Now, speaking of history and of old things, well, you may not know the name Thule Kupferberg, but he was somebody that was an important person. He really was. Founding member of the underground band The Fugs. He has died at the age of 86. He was a founding member of the underground left-wing 1960s band The Fugs, as well as a poet, political cartoonist, lifelong peace activist, and he died yesterday. He was the inspiration for a lot of people, including Lou Reed, Laurie Anderson, Sonic Youth, Philip Glass, and Lenny Kaye from the Patti Smith Group.
Hi, this is Lou Reed, and you're listening to WUSB Stony Brook.
Okay, well, Lou Reed just stopped in there to say hi to us. Thank you. That wasn't expected.
He's looking good.
Is Patti Smith around, too? Well, Philip Glass, you already heard from him with his music. A lot of people were inspired by this guy, and oftentimes it's the people you don't hear the name of that are the true inspiration behind so much that you do hear. According to producer Hal Wilner, with his poems, songs, and parodies, he always cut to the chase and got right to the point of what it was he was getting at. Always incredibly insightful, biting, yet done with hysterical, yet simplistic humor that one could not argue with his point of view. He basically told the audience at a benefit show that he was too ill to attend himself through a video. Go out there and have some fun. It may be later than you think. Kupferberg wrote the lyrics for one of the Fugs' signature songs, Kill for Peace, which the band played at its concerts as the Vietnam War was escalating in the mid-60s. We're going to play that song, because we have that right here, Kill for Peace by the Fugs. Yeah, the Fugs. What do you think, Kyle?
That's interesting.
Yeah, you never heard that before, did you?
I've never heard that song in my life. That's awesome.
It really is. The Fugs actually were an East Village band in New York City back in the early, mid-60s. And everybody there, of course, knew who they were. But, of course, the rest of the world, maybe not so much. But the spirit I think they did recognize. Now, Kupferberg, who died yesterday at the age of 86, Tuli Kupferberg, also wrote Nothing Nothing, a nihilistic song set to the melody of an old Yiddish song, which helped set the stage for the art rock outfits such as the Velvet Underground in the late 60s and much of the attitude of 70s punk music. According to veteran music industry executive Danny Goldberg, the Fugs were right on the barricade of what was possible. There was a fearlessness, an intensity, an unwillingness to pander to any commercial norms. That was very exciting. And I wish we had more of that, you know? I really do.
I second that.
Yeah. So go check out the Fugs if you have a chance. Spelled F-U-G-S. You'll find a lot of really interesting, funny music and just kind of the spirit of those days. There's a way to carry the spirit into these days, I think. You know, you're big with that. Taking something like the Telephone Museum and the Pioneers,
absolutely,
something from the past and applying it to the present and the future. And
I think that, yeah, the history, I mean, when you look at it, it has instructions for the future, and you can look at it and get some guidance and ideas and inspiration and learn stuff from the wisdom that people have accumulated over generations. And that's really crucial for young people to mm-hmm. really soak that wisdom up so that we're empowered and strengthened, you know, so we have information and the confidence to move into this future.
Right. It's not, we're talking about old telephones and old technology, but it applies to all parts of culture. You have to embrace the things that came before and learn from them and build upon those and never discard the past, never discard the history, because that's going to play a part. It's going to continue to play a part in future years.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's crucial. I'm very passionate about it. I've gained so much from learning and you know, you see so much of it in things around you all the time and issues and so.
But that link.
Can't say enough about it. Yeah.
Well, for instance, okay, just to get back, and we're going to go out tonight with something you taught me, actually, a musical piece that I had no idea was.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
Had such history to it. But before we get into that, another bit of history related to the telephone pioneers and various things that we've been discussing. We discovered through a book that you have called The Telephone Pioneers of America that they, in fact, had annual meetings all over the country. And guess where one of the places they had their annual meeting was? I believe in, what year was that?
1931.
Before my old phone was made, before your phone was even a dream.
That's right.
They had an annual meeting at the Hotel Pennsylvania.
They did.
The same place we're having our conference. And I was blown away by that, because I just happened to open up the book to that page, and there it was staring me in the face. Wow, they had their meeting on this particular day. They had the dates very specifically marked. And so what I did was I hopped on the Internet, and I typed in those dates, and Hotel Pennsylvania or Telephone Pioneers, and I found an antique bookstore that had the proceedings from that meeting.
That's right. They kept intricate transcripts of every meeting, and we have one copy of the transcript. And
that's right. I ordered the book. I startled whoever worked in that antique bookstore that I actually want this, and we just got it yesterday. It just showed up yesterday, this book in pristine condition that is basically a transcript of what was said at this meeting at the Hotel Pennsylvania. We're trying to figure out exactly where in the hotel this was. They make reference to a rooftop garden, I believe.
Yeah, I believe those were part of the events, though, for the event. They had dances and then rooftop garden. The actual the talks and the transcripts, where they were actually recorded, we don't yet have an exact location in the building. But I think this really speaks to the historical significance of the hotel and saving the hotel. And I'm sure there's some pioneers out there that have something to say about it, being significant.
There's a nice picture of the hotel too, and you noticed there was nothing
beautiful.
Nothing around the hotel. The hotel was just freestanding, and that alone just indicates the history of that place and why that should be preserved and how that matters so much.
Yeah.
It's really a common theme, isn't it, the history and,
yeah.
and how it links to the past. But I just thought it was incredible how we were able to find this. We were able to find out that they had a meeting in the same hotel that we're going to have our meetings at, or our conference at, and we were able to find the one remaining copy of this and get our hands on it right before the conference. It's just, it seems like destiny almost.
It really is. I'm stunned that you found it. You opened the book. It was the first thing you looked at. Your jaw dropped. I was still 50 pages away from reading my way.
Because I asked you. Did they have, you were talking about the meetings, and I said, did they have any meetings at the Hotel Pennsylvania? You said you didn't think so. And so I grabbed the book and just opened it to a random page, and the very first thing I see is a meeting at the Hotel Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And I just sort of was speechless at that point. And then, yeah, getting the book that quickly and... maybe we should reenact it.
We could verbatim.
Because they have dialogue going back and forth from the different people. Did you notice anything else in the book that was particularly fascinating or compelling?
It was a lot of the transcripts, a lot of what the proceedings, sort of a narration of what happened and in what order, and then the transcripts of a certain speech.
Their concerns about their meetings getting a little bit too big and out of control. Not unlike 2600 meetings,
there's
getting too big and out of control. Sometimes.
There's a lot of parallels. A
lot of parallels. And you may think that's weird because, well, aren't these telephone company people and we're hackers? Well, you know what? Look at the way phones were evolving. There was something completely new and different. Technology was moving what seemed like a mile a minute at the time. And people were suspicious of this sort of thing. We were reading something about communities that didn't want telephones.
Exactly.
You are near a community like that, are you not? In Washington.
Yes, Stehekin, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
They resisted the first telephone.
Resisted
in
the phones.
Stehekin. Yeah.
Wow.
But yeah, it's a history that's really interesting because they didn't even really know where it was going. They didn't know. I mean, this was an invention, and as soon as Bell came up with it, it was off and running. And
suspicion
and
of technology.
That. Yeah, and that theme of just getting equipment and technologies you don't know anything about, that's a big theme with the telephone company and
really
Bell.
Is. So. And you also have, in our closing moment, you also have copies of a magazine they used to put out.
Yes, which, the Pacific Telephone Magazine.
Pacific Telephone Magazine, and this is from when? What period?
Oh, geez. The copies I've got with me are from 1922. I believe the first ones came out in about 1920.
They are in incredible shape, and every single page is riveting and fascinating, and we have to figure out a way to share this with people. But right now, we are out of time. You know, I didn't plan on spending the whole show talking about this, but it's just such an interesting subject, and as you can see, there's just so much to cover and talk about. If you have comments or opinions or things to contribute, otw@2600.com is our email address. And now I'd like to do is close with the song that Kyle, I knew
the
song already.
It.
You were
yeah.
humming this song, and it's a song that I knew as Kurt Cobain, Nirvana doing. It's called "Where Did You Sleep Last Night," I believe.
Yeah, I think so.
Uh-huh. And it turns out there's all this history to it. It was actually originally called "In the Pines,"
mm-hmm.
and done. I think it came from the 1800s, song.
It's a folk song. I thought it was a blues song, but it's a folk song.
And we're going to hear a version from, I guess, around the time that my phone was made, in the 40s, maybe the 30s, by Leadbelly, that you may recognize as a Nirvana song. It all ties together.
Yes, it does.
All right. Kyle, looking forward to seeing you talk at Hope and all kinds of other fun things going on there.
I can't wait, and I'll see you there.
All right. We'll be back next week. Here's Leadbelly. Good night.
Good night.
My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? Come on, tell me, baby. In the pines, where the sun don't ever shine. I was shivering all night through. My girl, where will you go? I'm gone where the cold wind blows. Where's that, baby? In the pines, where the sun don't ever shine. I bet you will all night through. my girl, my girl, don't you lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? Come on and tell me something about it. In the pond, where the sun don't ever shine. I bet she did. Oh, not you. Shiver for me now. What happened down there? My husband was a hard-working man, killed him a mile and a half from here. What happened to him? His head was found in a driver wheel, and his body haven't ever been found. My good, my girl, don't you lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? Come on and tell me somebody. In the pines, where the sun don't ever shine. I bet you will, oh, not you.